And joining us now on the phone is John Mayer. John is the author of Learning from the 60s, Memoir of an Organizer. John, thanks so much for taking time to be with us this evening.
Well, I'm really glad I'm really glad we could both get together. How are things in Minnesota?
They're wonderful, as always. A little cool, of course. Now, where have we caught you?
Well, I live in Cambridge, Massachusetts,
okay.
But I grew up in Texas, so
right.
I'm not.
You're not very familiar with this. As I say, thanks again for being with us, and also want to let you know that I really enjoyed the book. I also am a child of the 60s, so it was very interesting to kind of be transported back to a lot of that again. Tell me, first of all, what prompted you to write the book, John?
Well, you know, I've been involved in organizing ever since 1962, and, you know, both as a union activist and then as a community organizer and back and forth. So, you know, at a certain point, I thought, well, gee, I must have learned a lot. And then you say, well, but what was it exactly, you know? And that's where the discipline of having to sit down and write and write and rewrite and whatever comes in to really figure out, you know, what did you learn?
Sure.
And I the book is interesting. It's got a lot of different aspects. But when I come to organizing, I try at the very end of each episode to really summarize.
Well,
you know,
yep.
What did I learn, and what is
and what happened
for organizers that are coming along? Because God knows we are in trouble, and we need organizing.
And well, you know, and I want to talk about it a little bit, but you grew up the 40s, the 50s in Houston, Texas, as you said.
Right.
You were from a what would have to be probably considered an affluent family. You were not. You and your brother were probably not what we would normally envision as prime candidates to become members of the New Left, to become community organizers, to become, in the words of the day, communist sympathizers.
Right.
What happened in your life that moved you from, you know, probably pretty conservative Houston, Texas, to where you the path that you found?
Well, you know, I was never sort of completely at ease in Houston, Texas. I mean, there was a lot of injustice. And, of course, racism and segregation were very much of the pattern in Houston in the 1940s and 50s. And I really didn't agree with that ever. So, you know, that was a part of it. But I will say the other part of it is that, you know, who wants to be an organizer? I mean, it's very satisfying, but it's pretty hard work. And the reason I became an organizer, I think, was, you know, all the other alternatives disappeared in the sense of, you know, I'd hoped to, after I graduated from Harvard, to get a job in Washington, you know, wear a coat and tie to work, advise, you know, I was on the senator's staff. I thought, you know, that was probably the way to change the country. And then, of course, the war came along. The escalation of the Vietnamese War. And I realized that you know, things weren't just going to happen the way I thought, that what we had to do was really address this question of the war directly, because the war was going to eat up all the money we needed for a real war on poverty.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think we're in very similar circumstances here where, you know, the war is a huge military budget we have is just sucking up the resources, sucking the life out of the country, out of a country that needs to invest in education, infrastructure, to get back to manufacturing, you know?
Now, you, as you mentioned, you came out of Harvard and in relatively short order went to work, I believe it was on Gaylord Nelson's.
That's right.
In his office. Young guy, fresh out of college, even out of Harvard, moving, you know, all of a sudden working on policy statements and developing policy and so forth for one of the more recognized liberal senators in the country. That must have been pretty heady stuff.
Well, it was really wonderful. And I, you know, it was a great place to be. The sort of the legislative director was a man named Gar Alperovitz, who's gone on to be a very noted economist.
Yeah.
You know, Senator Nelson himself was really a nice guy, you know, and it was like, of course, during the day he was Senator Nelson, and, you know, did exactly what I was told. But in the evening, you know, everybody'd gather around the table and drink a little beer, and he was Gaylord, and, you know, there was a lot of pushing and shoving and joking. And
compare, if you will, and I'm guessing that you do know, but compare, if you will, John, the Washington of those days, which would have been in the, what, late 50s, early 60s, and the Washington of today. You said you went there to thinking you could affect some change. It doesn't seem to me that anybody that goes to Washington today, including somebody elected as president of the United States, really can affect any change, that the system is so entrenched that it's really hard to change.
Well, it is a very desperate situation, and I think, you know, I'm very close personally to some of our Massachusetts Congress people, particularly John Tierney and Jim McGovern. And I just, you know, they go there and they fight a good fight, but it is really hard. It is really hard. It's rough. And, you know, I think there are many respects that, you know, the things that some of us expected from the Obama administration really have not worked out.
Right, right.
And so, you know, sort of, I think progressives in Congress have to fight on two fronts. On the one hand, they are the Republicans who seem to be getting sort of crazier by the month. But I think there's the Obama administration, which is sort of really not living up to its promises,
yeah,
at least in my opinion.
Yeah, yeah. So you went, let's get back to those days again, and you were in the office in Washington, but then moved from that into a little more hands-on activism, both in terms of labor activism. You got involved with the protest against the war in Vietnam really quite early, far earlier probably than most, and then went from there to community organizing. One of the things that I wanted to ask you, because we hear that name used a lot, community organizer. What really is a community organizer? I mean, for those people that hear it but don't really know what that is.
Well, you know, I think it really depends on, you know, there are many different varieties, and the truth is, you know, the right wing, the conservatives, they've done a lot of pretty good community organizing, too. My perspective and the people that I work with, the way we bring, what we bring to this is the notion that low-income working class people in particular have been pushed out of the political process, and they don't have any say about what happens with the government.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. If you're not involved in the process, the way well-to-do people are very involved in the process. They vote, they give a lot of money. So people in Lincoln Village in Worcester can't give a lot of money, but they, if they're organized, they can become a very powerful force, particularly if they're allied with middle-class progressives, seniors, organized labor. You can really create a coalition that can actually hold people accountable. And, you know, this word empowerment, you know, gets tossed around a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think some of the work that Neighbor to Neighbor, for example, does in Massachusetts and other organizations around the country where low-income working-class people can actually hold somebody to account and look them in the eye saying, well, you know, if you don't see things our way, we're going to find somebody else.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And really mean it and really elect somebody else. I think, you know, that's empowerment.
Yeah, yeah. Let's go back again a little bit into the 60s. You were very, as I mentioned, very involved with the protests, Vietnam War protests. In fact, actually, went to Paris, if I'm not mistaken, and delivered some information to some of the Vietnamese on behalf of your brother. But you were also there in Chicago, were you not, in 1968 for the Democratic Convention?
Right.
Talk a little bit about what that was like. I mean, a lot of us remember, you know, seeing it on the TV, reading about it in the newspapers. It seemed to be chaos in the best or worst sense. Talk a little bit about that. What was that like then?
Well, you know, it was really pretty awful, to tell you the truth. I mean, I think that, of course, people like yourself could look at it and see something right away, which is there was a lot of police brutality, and that's absolutely the case. But I felt that the people who were leading the demonstrations were extremely irresponsible. And, you know, they really set the movement up for Richard Nixon, who was then going to portray them as sort of not un-American, you know, not serious, whatever. You know, and so I think that, you know, you have to say, if you're going to talk about what did we learn in the 60s, well, one thing I think we need to learn is that you need to be very focused on the message and not do stupid things. Mm-hmm. You know, like Jerry Rubin and Abbie Hoffman said, we're going to come to Chicago and make love on the streets, except they didn't use the word make love, right?
Right, right.
You know, and that's not, you know, that's not serious. The police had thoroughly infiltrated the leadership of the, you know, the demonstrators. So you had cops allegedly demonstrating. I mean, they were in civilian clothes.
Sure,
big guys with tattoos all over their arms saying off the pig and stuff like that. And you knew that they were just, that they were sort of undercover policemen acting as provocateur, you know, trying to stir up trouble, trying to do something like tear down the American flag. That was a very famous thing that one of them did.
Sure.
That, you know, made the demonstrators look really stupid.
You know, that the, and again, talking about as you were growing up and then became involved, you got involved at a time when, at least the period leading up to that, was one of pretty conservative thought in this country. You know, when you look
Absolutely.
At the 50s and even into the early 60s. And it doesn't seem to me that there were a lot of role models for those of the people who got involved with protests against the war or the civil rights protests or any of that. Yeah, there weren't any really mentors. So how did you figure it out? I mean,
well, you know, I think we figured it out by sort of, you know, to a certain extent, making it up as we went along.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, what you had to do was the attitude of you were going to try things. And if something didn't work, you were going to try something else, you know. But, you know, in that period of time, you had to be pretty aggressive. And often that paid off, you know. Not accepting, for example, I remember once, you know, when I became a spokesperson for the anti-war movement, all the talk radio chieftains in the Boston area, they wanted to set me up so there would be some huge fight. So one of the early things I did was with the head of the Massachusetts Veterans of Foreign Wars, and he said, well, you know, those demonstrators should be horsewhipped. And so we got on the radio together, and he talked about, you know, how we needed to support the boys who were over there. And I looked him in the eye and said, I'm with you, absolutely. You know, we absolutely need to support them. They are in a very difficult circumstance. And then, you know, laid out the cause for, since we love them, let's get them out of harm's way.
Bring them home.
Not bow down to the politicians. And he looked at me and said, you know, it's those damn politicians. So we just had a wonderful time, you know, and that radio host was very frustrated.
I'm sure, because he was expecting a big battle.
That's right.
Battle royal.
A real cat fight.
Can you draw any similarities? I mean, I think people have tried to make the case for similarities between that time period, John, and this time period with, again, obviously a large portion of the population feeling disenfranchised and marginalized. You've got people hitting the streets, at least in a certain way, with the Occupy movements. I guess now we've finally ended the war in Iraq. That remains to be seen, but still are involved in a war in Afghanistan and who knows elsewhere. Are there similarities, and what are the similarities and what are the differences, particularly in terms of, if we can even use the phrase anymore, the left's response?
Well, you know, I think that there are some big differences that you have to take into account. I mean, I think that during the 60s, you know, the war was terrible, and the threat of being drafted, you know, fed a lot of the dissent. I mean, people didn't want to be drafted, and once they'd figured out that this war was absolutely made no sense from the point of view of protecting the United States. You know, people didn't want to go. But America at that point was pretty prosperous, that we could have a war and still remain prosperous. At least, you know, I think they were definite downsides, but you can make the argument that you could have guns and butter.
Mm-hmm.
I think right now, the draft is no longer an issue. What is the issue is, and I think it affects just about everybody, I mean, it really does affect the 99%, is that, you know, the resources that we need to really develop our country are being drained away by this empire that some of the people at the top seem to think is a good idea. You know, that we have the military capacity to intervene anywhere in the world, anytime, and that we don't have to be too careful about whether it's really in the defense of the country. It can be any one of a number of reasons, mm-hmm. as we saw in Iraq. You know, what was the reason for that?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think similarly in Afghanistan, I mean, we're fighting the Taliban. Now, the Taliban may not be the, you know, most noble human beings in the whole world, but they are not a threat to the United States.
Right.
The
right.
Taliban have no interest in coming over here and giving us a hard time. They're wickedly tough fighters on their own ground, but they are not a threat to the United States. And, you know, this war is preventing us, I think, from playing a potentially positive role in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
But, you know, to have a war is not a way to empower women, for example. You know, anybody who says that this war is being fought partly to protect the interests of Afghan women is just, you know, not really looking at what's happening.
We're visiting with John Mayer, the author of Learning from the 60s, Memoir of an Organizer. John, in the few minutes that we've got remaining, I know that you... You've been involved with, in fact, helped set up a movement called Neighbor to Neighbor there in Worcester, Massachusetts, and you had some phenomenal success. Can you tell us a little bit about what Neighbor to Neighbor is and what kind of things you're doing?
Well, you know, Neighbor to Neighbor is, I think, plays a very important role in the coalition in Massachusetts, which has given us, you know, I think the highest minimum wage in the country. We have just about everybody in Massachusetts is covered with health care. And what Neighbor to Neighbor brings to the table and focuses on is building chapters in low-income working-class communities so that people who've been excluded from the political process can have a say.
Mm-hmm.
And not surprisingly, they fight like hell for a higher minimum wage, for decent health care coverage for everybody, various important reforms of the criminal justice system, because, you know, one of the terrible problems we have in this country is there's so many young working class people who get a criminal record early in their life over many things that they probably shouldn't even be arrested for, like, you know, smoking a little marijuana or something. And and then they're virtually unemployable afterwards. So it's, you know... If we're going to have a real democracy, low-income working-class people have got to be at the table. And that's what Neighbor to Neighbor attempts to ensure in Massachusetts. And then there, you know, there are other organizations with a similar program around the country.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, number one, I guess I would like to thank you for your work on that behalf. You know, as we grow older, some of that stuff is a little tougher to do. But you have fought the good fight for a long time, and I appreciate that. And I also want to thank you very much for spending time with us this evening.
Well, I really enjoyed it. Let me just say that you can go to learningfromthe60s.com.
Oh, great.
And find out more about the book, about...
How to get the book, I hope.
Resources and many other things.
Great.
So, John, Bob, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.